As for the reading this morning, had to break it up a little bit. One thing about Proverbs, they're just short little terse things. And if you want a more three-dimensional look at what is being said, sometimes you have to go and hit several that are disjointed. But in each case where it talks about the lot is cast, we're going to be looking at probabilities. And a lot of times people look at the roll of the dice as just a chance encounter or whatever, but something like that in the casting of lots, it wasn't just a numeric probability that was coming up. As the proverb writer puts it, it was God's decision that was being made, not only with the lot, which was used by the apostles in Acts 1 to choose the replacement for Judas, but for something like it, the Old Testament high priest under the Mosaic law used to have the Urim and Thummim, and in some way he used that was a way of getting God's verdict on certain things. So a lot of times what people think are destiny or chance or certain probable outcomes, they overlook the fact that that in most cases it's God's decision. He's determining how things will go, and the probabilities are created by Him. So what we're doing is we're in the fifth of a series of looking at the various cases, either for creation or evolution. Of course, we're taking the creation side of it. And what we're trying to do is show that not so much Bible study in this, but just taking it from a scientific viewpoint, which is the most plausible model for how we all got here. And hopefully we're showing you or convincing you that the only two alternatives that we have, whether we were evolved from nothing or created by an intelligent designer, God, really the science stacks up for the creation model. And in many of these cases, what we've been looking at is the scientists themselves and in many cases evolutionists that have looked at what they've been doing for 20 or 30 years and going, maybe it does need an intelligent designer because what we're looking at doesn't hold water. And so this is what we're going to do this morning is carry on this from the laws of probability. And I find this probably the most interesting and most uncontroversial aspect of the case, in the sense that if you've ever taken statistics in college, the books I had, I never found one statistician who was an evolutionist. I mean, these guys are the ones that crank the numbers and the probabilities of this turning out, and they go, no way. And we're going to look at some of that this morning. Again, I'm going to use the overheads. Okay, this should match your handout. There's some more in the back if you need them. It's really this one of the limitations of science is that by its very nature, it deals not with absolute proof, but with probability. Okay. This is the way it's put in a widely used biology text by G.G. Simpson. The student is warned, we speak in terms of acceptance, confidence, probability, not proof. When I was younger, I used to think, well, it seems like science has all the absolute verifiable facts, and Christianity and proof for God just seems to like you kind of got to stack it up to see which has the greater weight. But it comes out that really science doesn't have anything absolute either. It's a probability. Even though as you think of science of I can put it in the test tube and it's going to come out this way, every time. Well, not every time. Okay, the greater probability is that it will, but sometimes you never know what you put in the mix. An unclean test tube, whatever. All these things are the random things that go into any experiment. Or you could just about to be done with the petri dish and the ceiling tile falls in and gets in the whole mess. So you're dealing with probabilities in most cases. If by proof is meant, and this is according to Mr. Simpson here, that the establishment of eternal absolute truth open to no possible exception or modification, then proof has no place in the natural sciences. And that's their statement. Now, today almost every scientific discipline is based on the laws of probability. At the outset of any discussion on probabilities, however, two questions arise. First, are probabilities of any practical nature? Yes, we're going to be looking at that. One of the things that was interesting during World War II is when the Allies started capturing German tanks, they could look at the identification numbers on them and figure out by probabilities how big a tank force the German has just by their ID numbers. So probabilities has got a very useful practical application in all sorts of things. The second is, are probabilities of any usefulness in the creation evolution controversy? Well, the answer is yes again. James Coppedge, a former director of probability research, has stated probability is a practical concept. The uncertainties of chance affect our everyday lives. Ask any weatherman. Okay. Now, in the nature of probability, Mr. Borel, ever the practical mathematician, remarked that the principles on which the calculus of probabilities is based are extremely simple and as intuitive as the reasonings which lead an accountant through his operations. So it's as exact a science as anything that's out there. Okay. King and Reed, in their excellent work, Pathways to Probability, stated, we see that the theory of probabilities is at the bottom, only common sense is at the bottom, only common sense reduced to calculation. That's all it is. Common sense that you can calculate. Indeed, whether most people realize it or not, our daily lives are affected by such mathematical studies, sometimes in ways we do not even know or understand. When you get insurance, the actuary has been busy figuring out the probabilities of how much your policy is going to cost. By looking at the probability of whether you're going to die within the next couple of years or not. Harold Morowitz, former professor of biophysics at Yale University, commented, often a process is so complicated and we are so ignorant of the boundary conditions or of the laws governing the process that we are unable to predict the result of the process in any but statistical fashion. In elections, this is why they take polls. Hopefully by a random choice, they can figure exactly pretty much where the percentages are going to go. Again, back to the weatherman, taking in all the factors that they can, trying to predict which way a storm is going to turn, how violent it's going to be, trying to calculate earthquakes. All these are in the realms of probabilities. Randomness is, in a certain sense, a consequence of the ignorance of the observer, yet randomness itself displays certain properties which have been turned into powerful tools in the study of the behavior of the system of atoms. So even though the variables are beyond us at times, there still is sort of a pattern to things that help us figure things out. Since probability studies deal with randomness, and since evolution in its entirety is built upon the very concept of randomness, it would appear that the laws of probability should shed some light on the possibility of evolution having occurred. You bet. Great place for it. If evolution is all random processes and stuff like that, and probability has to do with figuring out random processes, the two should go together. Or as one person put it, evolution is an ideal subject in which to apply the laws of chance. Evolutionary doctrine denies advanced planning and has random matter in motion as its basic source. Chance mutations furnish the variability upon which presently accepted evolutionary thinking in America is generally founded. Same guy, Coppedge, who was the director of probability research. Okay? So the best of them say that, probability should be used in trying to figure out evolution. Okay, Now, what happens when you start applying the laws of probability to whether evolution is possible or not? Borel's law of probability states that the occurrence of any event where the chances are beyond 1 in 1 followed by 50 zeros is an event that we can state with certainty will never happen. No matter how much time is allotted, no matter how many conceivable opportunities could exist for the event, this is a big number. This 1 followed by 50 zeros. Because the laws of probability say if you go beyond that, it isn't going to happen. Ever. Not now, not ever, never. Dr. Morawitz estimated that the probability for the chance formation of the smallest, simplest form of living organism known is 1 chance in 1 followed by 340 million zeros. If after you get past 50 zeros, probability says it's not going to happen, for the simplest living organism, the smallest, simplest cell, the probability that's been figured that it can happen by random is not 50 zeros, but 340 million zeros. They've also figured there's not that many electrons in the whole universe. So the probability of even the simplest cell occurring by random would not have happened by chance. Would not have happened. Dr. Carl Sagan estimated that the chance of life evolving on any given single planet like the Earth is 1 chance in 1 times 10 to the 2 billionth. Okay. I mean, this is the good doctor saying, okay, I figured out what it would take for life to occur. And, I mean, your zeros ran out about right there of ever happening. According to the statistician, life could never occur. Never. Numbers this large are so infinite beyond 1 followed by 50 zeros that according to Borel's law of probability, there is absolutely no chance that life could have evolved spontaneously on Earth. Underline that. No chance. If we assume the universe to be 50 billion years in radius, as some assert, and assume that it is crammed with tiny particles the size of electrons, it has been estimated that conceivably 10 to the 130th particles would exist in the universe. Every structure, every process, every system, every event in the universe must consist of these particles in various combinations and interchanges. If, to be extremely generous, we assume that each particle can take part in 10 to the 20th, that is 100 billion events each second, and then allow 10 to the 20th seconds of cosmic history, which would correspond to 3 billion years, or 100 to 200 times the current maximum estimate of the age of the universe, they still think it's roughly around 4.5 billion. But if you gave them 3,000 billion, then the greatest conceivable number of separate events that could take place in all of space and time would be 10 to the 170th events. Which is way less than this. I mean, if you gave everything in the universe more than enough time to bang itself into everything else, it still wouldn't have enough time and opportunity to do what the evolutionists said happened. The problem is that any living cell or any new organism to be added to an existing animal, even the simplest imaginary replicating system, would have to contain far more stored information than represented even by such a gigantic number as 10 to the 170th. Marcel Gallet, a leading information scientist, calculated the odds against such a system organizing itself as 1 to 10 to the 450th. Frank Salisbury figured the number fairly the same thing. Consequently, it can be concluded that chance origin of life is utterly impossible. just going by the numbers. Or, I like the way we start out, common sense. Okay, put the numbers. I mean, just stopping to think about it. If you give your time to stop and think about it, it can't happen. Just can't happen. So which model is logically possible? R.W. Kaplan, who spent years researching the possibility of the evolutionary origin of life, suggested that the probability of the simplest living organism being formed by chance processes was 1 chance in 10 to the 130th. We're still over, past 10 to the 50th. Okay. He then stated, one could conclude from this result that life could not have originated without a donor of information. Creationists suggest that a donor was the creator and that the evolutionary model cannot circumvent basic laws of probability. Okay. So according to this statistician, is that creation model carries more weight. You need somebody to insert into all this some sort of order, some kind of command, some kind of direction. Evolutionist Richard Dawkins once observed, the more statistically improbable a thing is, the less we can believe that it just happened by blind chance. Superficially, the obvious alternative to chance is an intelligent designer. Now, this is the problem that even the scientists and the statisticians are running into, trying to get their point across to these guys. Okay? The problem with the distorted thinking of the evolutionists is that when you state that something has a one chance in, they only see the one as if, you mean there's a chance. And they're trying to tell you, no, don't look at the one. There is no chance. I mean, this is what he goes on to say. For them, it means there's a chance no matter what. But Sproul, Gessner, and Lindsley concluded, the fact is, however, we have a no-chance creation. We must erase the one which appears above the line of the one followed by a large number of zeros. What are the chances of a universe created by chance? Not a chance. Chance is incapable of creating a single molecule, let alone an entire universe. Why not? Chance is no thing. I mean, stop to think about it. You say there's a chance it can happen, all right? Who's this chance guy? I mean, what is it? Can you put it in a test tube? Can you identify it? Can you tell me what it is? No, there's no such thing. Chance is incapable of creating a single molecule, let alone an entire universe. Why not? Chance is a no thing. It is not an entity. It has no being, no power, no force. It can affect nothing, for it has no causal power within it. It has no itness to it. Set out a pool table. Okay? Put all the balls there and figure out what's the chance of anybody hitting the cue ball into the whole stack of balls and every one of them going to a pocket. Absolutely none, unless somebody hits the cue ball. And even then, where did the balls come from? Where did the table come from? Where did the stick come from? Where are the guys going to hit them all? Chance has nothing by itself. Those balls can sit there from now to the end of eternity, and chance isn't going to do a thing to them, unless something else gets it all started and designs it all. Claude Tresmontin, an eminent philosopher of science from the University of Paris, stated, no theory of chance can explain the creation of the world. Before chance can send atoms swirling through infinite void, the atoms have to exist. How does chance create an atom or make anything? Mathematician Murray Eden in defense said, the randomness, now this is their best defense. Okay, for chance. The randomness postulate is highly implausible, and that adequate scientific theory of evolution must await the elucidation of new laws, physical, chemical, and biological. What he's saying is, there's nothing in science right now that'll give you any kind of proof for evolution until we come up with some new laws. That's their best defense. There's nothing out there now that can prove evolution, or even the probability of it, unless they come up with something else. You know, change our science. Probability doesn't create anything. And we'll try to give you a little bit more examples here. This is from something else. In fact, I got this out of one of my statistics books. Put it in a little bit better terms. One statistician, N.C., and I hate this guy's name, Wickhamsing, whatever, of University College in Cardiff, Wales, state that the chance of these amino acids, that is the building blocks of life, that's just the amino acids, not the peptides and everything else, randomly shuffling together to form the earliest prokaryotes, you know, or simple bacteria, is about 1 in 10 to the 40,000th power, way beyond 50. Or the same chance as a tornado blowing through a junkyard and producing a jumbo jet. Again, these are the statistics, you know, being cranked out. I mean, if you can think about one of our little dust devils going, or a nice massive tornado, and we got a junkyard over where we live, going through all these car parts and everything else, and putting a jumbo jet together, perfectly designed, and have it fly. Or they said, yeah, the general evolutionist may claim that a monkey randomly hitting the keyboard of a typewriter could eventually produce the complete works of Shakespeare. But the statistician will tell you that the length of time for that to happen, given the rules of probability, would take, and I don't even know what that number is. You know, but you got other questions too. Find me a monkey that lives that long. It'll teach you that, take you that long to teach that monkey how to type to begin with, let alone produce all the works of Shakespeare. Some of these things, when it talks about probabilities, I mean, you can go to, just say, we turned the moon into a glass sphere, and we filled it full of BBs. And roughly the chances of life, or if you could find one black BB, you know, in the middle of all those BBs that fill the moon. And I'm being conservative because usually they use, if you can fill the sun with that amount. But, you know, again, you know, the if you see there's one chance in it, I mean, there is that one black BB. But what the evolutionist doesn't understand is, okay, you got 5 seconds to find it. And how are you going to get to the moon from the Earth to begin with? You know, they want to start at some place where they're not there yet. And this is their problem of trying to take on statistics. You know, it's just evolution is so impossible. By just about every law of science there is. But you're going to find diehard people. I think I got one more quotation here, and then I'll give you a little bit more practical application of all this, and the rest will be yours. By the admission of its supporters, the only way that the theory can be accepted and propagated is by the elucidation of completely new natural laws in the physical, chemical, and biological sciences. The logical impossibility of holding to such a theory under present natural laws hardly needs further comment. Evolution is such a theory and should therefore be rejected because it is impossible, both probabilistically and logically. Like I said, we could leave it as a conclusion there, except for one of the things that in the news just came up is, you know, well, who cares? You know, even if they teach evolution in school, you know, okay, you sit through the first chapter that covers it, and then you get in all the good stuff and just ignore it. And you can't. But there's going to be some ramifications in the nature of, and we want to put it this way, is we don't want to leave the impression that all scientists, you know, have been smoking something. I mean, there's some good scientists out there. There's some good men of, you know, with credentials and stuff that really know what they're talking about. I mean, some of them are taking a, you know, stand for creation. So we're not saying that, you know, every scientist is absolutely stuffed full of blueberry muffins. But the problem in a lot of universities now is that the evolutionists, and these guys a lot of times don't think straight. are in control. So you can go through, and I know of at least one case where a person went through and was trying to get a doctorate at a certain university, and he got turned down, even though he passed all the courses, you know, with straight A's. He still got turned down for his doctorate because he was a creationist. He believed in God. And they figured anybody that believed in God doesn't have any sense. And so they didn't want to give him his doctorate. Okay. But, okay, that probably doesn't affect you either. One of the things that just came out this week is the UN just published its big study on global warming. And if all this stuff begins to be taken seriously, it's going to cost you some big bucks and going to turn your world upside down. They just presented, like, you know, all these leading scientists have determined that we're on a radical, you know, climb into global warming that's going to wipe us all out. It's based on two probability models. And there's a lot of models out there. But they decided to take the two radical ones, most radical, and this is their bent. You know, they've already admitted, these guys, that they don't care, you know, they don't mind twisting the facts and inflating the numbers if they can get their point across. And so what they've done is use models that are absolutely too simplistic. They don't take in all the variables. And whatever numbers they crank into them, that's the numbers they're getting out. And so, according to them, you know, the Earth is going to be, you know, bursting into flames. You know, who knows, you know, how quickly. What other scientists have tried to say, and they're shutting them out now. They're not listening to them. Okay, you know, where it should be an open court of views and things, they're now pretty much, you know, they're not listening and not letting people talk. There was a very intelligent conversation, you know, held by a Canadian scientist that said these models are worthless. He says we've already cranked in the numbers for past events, you know, that have already happened, and the models couldn't even predict what we knew was supposed to happen. They were off like 300%. I mean, if your calculator was off that bad, you'd throw it away. But they're using this stuff, and it's going to cost you money. Or somebody else put it, what's the problem with global warming? Okay. Are the seas going to increase? Yeah, but the seas have always been increasing. But we overlooked that. So we're going to have more water covering the garbage we put in there. So we're going to have more groundwater leaking into the continents so we have more drinking water. Wow, our winters are going to be a little bit milder, so the growing period for food is going to be longer. Okay, what's the problem, guys? Because we have less cold winters, we're not going to be burning as many fossil fuels, so the air is going to get better. And even if the air doesn't get better, and we're pumping all this carbon dioxide into it, how about that? That's what plants thrive on. We're giving them more to breathe. I mean, the logic of it. But it's not going that way anyway. I mean, when you actually take temperature readings, you find out it's getting cooler, if nothing. The measure of the Sahara Desert, you know, the desert's getting smaller. You know, the jungle's starting to encroach on it. You can look at some ice packs in the north saying, oh, they're starting to melt, but there's ice packs in Antarctica that are increasing. No, God's in control. God's in control. You know, and if man gets, you know, let things get out of hand, God will just have us to have another world war, and we'll get rid of more humanity, and everything will get back into balance. Or as some little old lady once said, she said, in the problems of overpopulation and pollution, what's the problem? One solves the other. Think about it. You know, there's going to be a balance anyway. Yeah, but God is in control. And so don't listen to alarmists and don't listen to bad science, because it's going to cost you a lot. And that's the things we should take from this. You know, listen to both sides of the argument, which is what everybody should be doing, creation and evolution, and get the facts and figure out for yourself. God is not afraid of the truth. What are all the scientists afraid of? If they're covering up the truth. And of course, if we've convinced you that there is a God, with knowledge comes responsibility. If there is a God, has he contacted us? Yeah. He wouldn't set everything in motion and then not leave us a plan. I mean, if God is an intelligent designer, there's a design to all of it. There's a purpose to all of it. There's something he wants from us. And he wants it from us because it's for our own good. And we need to listen to him. Christianity, we're trying to convince those that aren't, that don't believe in God, but even for us that do believe in him. Too often, Christianity is like a vast ocean and we're just putting our toes in it. You know, we test the waters and go, oh, it's not for me. It doesn't work that way. You've got to take the plunge. The guy that invented the first parachute, you know, he couldn't just run along the ground and watch it fill with air. At some point, he had to jump out of a plane and really commit himself to it. And that's what Christianity is. It's a trust in God to put yourself wholly and fully into it, to let God rule your life, to have a confidence in his guidance over everything, that he cares for us, that he loves us, he's looking out for us, he's there to help us whenever we need him. In view of that, an invitation is always extended by him. Quit trusting yourselves, quit trusting in the world, quit trusting in scientists, trust in God. You know, a lot of these theories will come and go. I mean, theory evolution isn't even new. I mean, the Egyptians thought we all crawled out of the Nile at one point. Eventually, it was shown to be wrong. But God's eternal truths have always been eternal and true. Trust in him. Yeah. As he calls you to his service for your own benefit, heed the call. It's always extended. Won't you come as we stand to sing?